to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a playwright and co-founder of the River Run Theatre Company in Madison, Indiana, who's written extensively for the stage and is the editor of online theatre community 2AMT. He also writes and produces this very network's incomparable radio theatre show, which is enjoying its second season right now, so you should go and subscribe to that too. And welcome back to the show, David Law.
Thank you for having me. I love to talk James Bond anytime, and I haven't had a chance to yet.
Ah, well, this is your chance. And, okay, well, anybody who's downloaded the show will know we are going to talk about Honor Majesty's Secret Service. That's no secret. But I do want to explain up front why we are doing this in what is effectively our Christmas episode. This might be a bit obscure to Americans, but you see, over here, and I'm sure you know this because I know you're... Yes. Very well versed in British culture, but over here, and I think I have mentioned this before on the show, actually, it's a holiday tradition, and not just Christmas holidays, but pretty much any public holiday, to show a James Bond movie on TV. I mean, back when we, you know, dinosaurs roamed the earth and we only had three TV channels over here, it was a proper, like, half the country gathered around the telly tradition. You know, the right. Whichever channel had the Bond movie, the other channels would just put horse racing or something on because it was pointless trying to compete because everybody would watch the Bond movie. Obviously, things have changed quite a bit, but even now with hundreds of channels spewing, you know, endless cheap TV that nobody actually watches, one of the big three channels over here, BBC One, BBC Two, or ITV, at least one of them will still show a Bond movie on public holidays over here, and at Christmas, pretty much guaranteed. So, hence the Christmas episode. Let's talk Bond.
And this is a fitting one, just in terms of setting and timing, and you know, it's snow filled and skiing and.
Well, and I think it does actually take place just before Christmas, doesn't it? Because they keep talking about Christmas being near. So yeah, you know, I hadn't even thought of that.
Well, and this is one of the more maligned films. I mean, it's not the Roger Moore ones, but it has been maligned a fair bit over the years.
It has, and it's like I'll ask you about your experiences in a moment. My experience was that I didn't see this until after I had already seen plenty of Roger Moore,
right?
Because that was what I grew up with. Roger Moore was Bond when I was growing up and watching movies. And then Timothy Dalton, who was a breath of fresh air after Moore. I could do a whole episode just about Timothy Dalton. I think he was a great Bond, let down by, you know, some bad scripts. But anyway, so I'd seen mostly Roger Moore, the Dalton movies, and I had seen a few of the early Connery movies, although it took me years to get around to seeing all of them. Before I saw Honor Majesty's Secret Service, but I'd heard of it partly because of my mother, who loves a good Bond movie, and she spoke well of it. I think she liked the fact that Diana Rigg's in it, to be honest, because she was also, my mother was a big fan of the Avengers TV show and most of those sort of 60s spy and spy adjacent shows from ITC and ATV and the like that we had over here. Which now that I think about it is probably why I love those TV shows so much, and they've been quite an influence on my work. So thanks, Mom. Merry Christmas.
I can say pretty much the same thing. This was my mother's favorite of the early Bond films.
Really?
And she too. You know, it's like she brought me up all of the things you hear popping up in the radio theater. She introduced me to those when I was really little. All of the things that influenced that, and you know, so I knew about the Avengers, and I knew about Bond, and we had all the books on the shelf. I mean, I read most of the books by the time I was 13, because they were there, and we would talk about things. You know, it's like I had the carte blanche to read whatever I wanted that was in the house, as long as we talked about it and discussed it, which was a great way to learn about structure and, you know, all the different things about how the books were made and I mean, it really kind of explains a lot about what I do. It's like I was bred to be a pulp radio goofball. I don't know. And so, yeah, one of the things she always respected about this film particularly is how close it is to the book, which most of them are not.
Right, not at all, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I did a little research last week just to brush up on it. And what's interesting is, I mean, obviously the films are filmed all out of order compared to the books. And the books don't have a heavy chronology to them, but the later ones do. And so, you know, Thunderball and You Only Live Twice and On Her Majesty's Secret Service and The Man with the Golden Gun all tie together with this sort of Blofeld story. And they filmed them out of order. But what was interesting is, after Thunderball, they had planned to do On Her Majesty's Secret Service and changed it up because they would have had to look for snowy locations. And they said, well, the timing's all wrong. Let's do You Only Live Twice.
Ah.
And as a result, when Bond meets Blofeld in this film, they ignore the fact that he just met him in the last film.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't even recognize him, does he?
Yeah. I mean, it's convenient that they're both totally different actors, but...
That's true.
Yes. You know, it's just, it's weird. And so, yeah, it's
see, I hadn't noticed that because, of course, I've watched them out of order. So right, that never right. even occurred to me, but you're right, yeah.
Yeah. I went through a thing about 20 years ago where I sat down with the books and read them in order properly. I had never read them in order. And then I went through the movies in the movie order just to sort of compare and contrast. And it was really interesting. And it was interesting to see just how much they had, you know, in most of the movies, you know, what they ignored, what they kept, and then what they shuffled from story to story to say, okay, this was a good detail that we didn't use here, so let's use it here. And like there are bits of For Your Eyes Only that are from the book of Live and Let Die. And in Live and Let Die, there's the moment where Felix Leiter is thrown to the sharks, and Bond finds him with a note pinned to him that says he disagreed with something that ate him. Well, they used that in the Dalton License to Kill.
I was going to say, yeah, that's like that's way way after Connery right. stuff, yeah.
And when they did novelizations of some of them. Some of the later ones with John Gardner doing a couple and all. So they had a novel version of License to Kill where Gardner, thinking about the chronology of the books, has the same thing happen, but the note pinned to him says he disagreed with something that ate him again. It's like, oh my God, no.
and poor Felix Leiter, I mean, his chronology in the movies is completely messed up anyway. I don't think when has he ever been played by the same actor more than once? It's you know, it's worse than Blofeld.
Only in the Daniel Craig movies. That's the only time really? It's been consistent. Yeah.
Wow. So like every.
See, I told you I like talking Bond.
Every actor who's played Bond, every run of Bond, as it were, has had at least one clunker. And for Connery, you know, that's probably Diamonds Are Forever.
Oh yes.
Which pretty much everybody agrees is, you know, terrible. For Moore, I'd say that's probably Moonraker, or maybe A View to a Kill, but I don't know. I've got a soft spot for A View to a Kill.
A View to a Kill is not bad. The only real problems with it, the Bond girl is not the greatest, and
wait, do you mean Grace Jones?
Oh, no.
Oh, I was going to say, she's fabulous.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Right.
And I'm just, Roger is so old. At
well,
that point.
Too, yeah. Yeah, he's drawing his pension.
But, you know, if it had been, you know, if just looking at it in the abstract, it's actually not a bad script. It's,
well,
it could have been so much better.
Right. But Moonraker is, pretty much everybody agrees that Moonraker is,
oh, yeah.
That's bad. Daniel Craig has got Quantum of Solace, which divides people, but, you know, he's generally regarded. The sort of consensus, I think, is that's the worst of his movies.
I might say Spectre is.
Wow, ooh, controversial.
Yeah.
And then Brosnan's got, now I got these mixed up when we were chatting the other day. Not, which one's the one with the newspaper?
Tomorrow Never Dies.
Right, so it was the one after that was The World Is Not Enough. That's
yes.
the one of his that pretty much, that's the one with Christmas Jones, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right, that's, you know, that's his clunker. Personally, I actually think Tomorrow Never Dies is pretty bad as well, but, you know. So everybody's got one clunker. Here's the theory. Yeah. Everybody's got one clunker, but they've also got good movies, you know, and great movies that sort of people, you know, go, well, okay, one of them was bad, but this one was great. Poor George Lazenby only made one movie because of his idiot of an agent. And as a result, like the only movie he did is everybody, well, not everybody, okay, but most people, and certainly at the time, you know, regard it as his clunker. That's his bad movie. And of course, it's the only one he did. Poor guy. Yeah.
Well, and it has, I mean, it kind of fits the pattern just because he has one good movie and one bad movie. And it's the it's same, the same movie. You know, there are bits and pieces of it that are so good. And then he starts talking.
I'm relieving you from Operation Bedlam, 007.
But sir, Blofeld, something of a must with me.
You've had 2 years to run him down.
Does this mean you've lost confidence in me?
I'm well aware of your talents, 007. The license to kill is useless unless one can set up the target. I'll find you a more suitable son. That's all.
So under the
circumstances... That's all.
That was a quick conference. How do you expect a girl to keep herself alluring?
Take a memo, please, Moneypenny.
Ready, James.
Sir, I have the honor to request you will accept my resignation, effective forthwith.
Resignation from what?
Her Majesty's Secret Service. And kindly present us that monument in there.
He has his moments. It's, you know, for a good part of the movie, he's dubbed by another actor.
Yeah, no.
Which... A good actor, yeah. Well, it seemed strange to me, even at the time, you know, I realized he was dubbed to match the voice of the actor.
George Baker, yeah.
Playing Hillary, Sir Hillary, that he's impersonating. And at the time I thought, why didn't he impersonate the other, why didn't they dub his voice for the other actor so that he could keep his own voice?
Do you know Sir Lynn, Sir Hillary?
I'm afraid not, Fräulein
Bund.
Bund. Interesting name for a genealogist. Are you from a naval family?
Naval?
It's a nautical term, you see, meaning the baggy or swollen parts of a sail. Nothing personal, of course.
Interesting. You speak German?
I'm afraid not.
French, perhaps?
A little. Where are we off to?
You will not be disappointed. Please?
Sir Hillary Bray is the character.
That's right.
Apparently... I mean, you're right, but apparently they did try and do a version with Lazenby attempting to imitate George Baker, and he just couldn't pull it off. It was apparently terrible, and that's why they dubbed Baker's voice over. So I suspect, I mean, you're right that maybe with hindsight that would have been a better way to do it, but I'm guessing that they didn't realize that until they were already deep into the sort of post-shooting, post-production process.
Oh, probably. And you know, Baker really is a much better actor, so...
Oh, well, yes.
That doesn't hurt, you know.
Very early role for him as well, actually.
Really?
In the span of his whole career, because he's best known over here, I think, as playing Ruth Rendell's character, Inspector Wexford. Already a sort of late middle-aged detective by the time, you know, the stories begin, and that's how he played the character. So, yes, he's best known over here as an almost retirement-age detective. So seeing him in this, where he's not like he's a young man, but he's a lot younger than in the Wexford shows. It's quite a, you know, it's a bit like, oh yeah, blimey, I forgot he was in this.
I kept trying to pay attention because I know Joanna Lumley shows up as one of the many women.
And has one line.
Thing. And I kept missing her, and so that's why I went back and watched it again. It was like, and she plays England.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. Well, you've also got the main sort of Bond girl, Ruby, from Lancashire. But anybody, Lancashire is where I live now, actually. And anybody who knows England will know that Lancashire, Yorkshire and England may as well be three separate countries. So, you know, kind of counts. I didn't see this for a long time. As I say, I'd already seen lots of other Bond movies before I saw it. And I never... And I went into it with a sort of favourable attitude because, as I say, my mother spoke well of it. And I remember watching it and thinking, well, it's fine. It's just a Bond movie. Not as silly as the Roger Moore movies, but, you know. And then found out later, of course, that it's pretty much universally reviled, or was at the time anyway. And I hadn't actually watched it for years before I then went back to see it again for the show. And I know that critical reaction to it has softened quite a bit over the years. And I can kind of see why, because going back and looking at it now, I'm like, actually, this is a pretty good Bond movie. I mean, yes, Lazenby is not the best actor in the world, but, you know, being a great actor is not really a requirement for those 60s and 70s era Bond movies, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't think I have seen it in about 30 years.
Wow.
Or close to it. But I remember at the time being on the edge of my seat. It was like, oh man, this is not the typical Bond film. It's much more like the book. It's got Diana Rigg, which, I mean, that
immediately
warmed the cockles of my heart, shall we say. And, you know, I was really into it, and it was a different relationship for Bond and a different way into the story for him. Even, it is a very, very atypical story. And then, of course, the ending, you know, that's the big moment for Bond. And I, you know, I kind of feel, at least until Daniel Craig, I should say.
Right.
And, you know, I even at the time, I felt bad that, oh, they wasted this on him. Oh, you know, because it would have been really good with Connery. I don't know that Moore could have pulled that off.
Right, yeah.
You know, he even in his earliest ones, or even For Your Eyes Only, which that might be my favorite of his, which takes Bond a little more seriously again after Moonraker. I think he just he was too light for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he was fine at what he did. And I mean, I love the Saint series that he did, which, again, not high art, but it's fun. So, you know, I don't know that they would have. And they did want more even earlier on for the series. And the Saint tied him up. It's kind of funny how.
A bit like Brosnan.
Exactly. They pick an actor, and then the people who have their TV claws at him go, oh, wait, we can get more attention.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know that he could have pulled it off at that point.
How interesting would that have been, though, thinking about it, you know, just speculating, how interesting would it have been if they'd made basically this movie, the same movie, with Moore, and then, like, continued to make what we now think of as Moore-era Bond movies, which of course are much lighter and jokier and more comedic in tone after the tragedy of, you know, of his wife being killed. That's an interesting hypothetical to think about.
It might have been a much better run of movies because, you know, taking this story and putting more into it and doing it the way they did it would have set a different tone and a different template.
And you compared it to Daniel Craig. And of course, that is essentially, you know, the sort of route they took with Craig's movies was, you know, you have, okay, you know, he doesn't marry Vesper Lynd and she turns out to be a traitor and all that, but nevertheless, the emphasis in Casino Royale is clearly that she is his great love and, you know, he can't save her, he loses her and drives him over the edge and what have you. But then they have used that to then in the two latest movies make him a bit lighter hearted and a bit more flippant, and we're nowhere near approaching the level of Roger Moore, I mean, even in something like Spectre. But we are closer to that than we were in Casino Royale, for sure.
Yes, yes. Oh, I saw Skyfall in the theater, and there was it wasn't the whole audience, but you could tell who had been fans for decades, because there was a sort of light undercurrent of, whoa, at the end of the movie, when he walks in to meet Rafe Fiennes as M, and he walks through the leather doors.
The famous padded door, yeah.
It just looks like the classic Bond office scene.
I haven't seen a shot-by-shot, actually. Or sorry, I should say a shot-to-shot comparison, but I wonder how closely they modelled that on the office of M that we see, actually, in this movie quite a bit. It features in several scenes in this movie. And we get a good look at it. Yeah, I don't know how close it is.
Because I know even we wound up watching Skyfall this weekend too, by accident. I'll explain that. And
we've gone on holiday by mistake. No, wrong movie.
And what was interesting is I know that they had worked in references to all the previous films, just little visual things and in jokes and stuff that don't get in the way of the story, but they celebrate the fact that it was the 50th anniversary of the films.
Right, right.
And I picked up on a lot more of them this time. I'm sure there's a list somewhere online that I could go and cheat, but it's more fun to go, hey, he stepped on the back of the Komodo dragon. I bet that's a reference to Live and Let Die. Yay.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Yeah. We wound up watching it because, I found a trove of Bond films online. They are on Hulu, at least in America. And then one of the cable channels that we pick up on Sling TV did a marathon of them for Thanksgiving as well. So it was sort of nice to be able to just sort of dip in and go, oh, here's this scene from this, and here's this, and here's this.
Oh, right.
And my older son, who is 14 now, he was, you know, he's sitting on the couch with his iPad and kind of looking up every now and then going, what's this? Oh, that's a 70s Bond film. Oh, okay. Back to the iPad. And then looking up, what's this? Oh, this is a Connery film. Okay. Back to the iPad. And one thing after a while, I was just watching the title sequences, mostly to hear the songs. And one thing I had never appreciated, I saw a lot of these on broadcast TV the first time, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen them since in some cases. And I realized just how artfully they framed the opening credits or dimmed them for broadcast TV.
Oh, right.
And after a while, I'm kind of looking at them and paying more attention to Maurice Binder's odd title designs. I know people love Maurice Binder's title designs. It's odd. He seems to have a certain fetish for trampolines and silhouettes and naked women. And after a while, my son looks up and he goes, what is going on? I said, do you realize I've been sitting here watching, do you know how many naked lady parts have been on the TV in the last hour? And he looks at me like, what? And I showed him another, I think it was Moonraker or The Spy Who Loved Me. And he just sat there mesmerized. Like, they could do that? Like, oh, son, yes.
This is the Bond viewer's equivalent of reading something for the articles.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, no, I was just watching it for the music. You mentioned From Russia With Love. And one of the things that I didn't realize, but when I was looking into this before recording, apparently the producers specifically looked back to From Russia With Love when they were making this movie because the later Connery movies, of course, had gotten quite fantastical with, you know, right. Your volcano bases and your, you know, space satellites and all that sort of stuff. And they deliberately wanted to make it a bit more grounded and a bit more realistic. And apparently, you know, specifically said more like From Russia With Love. And it just so happens that From Russia With Love is one of my favorite Bond movies.
Oh, it's terrific.
Yeah. Partly because, I've said this before, partly because it is one of the only Bond movies that is actually a spy story, where mm-hmm. he actually does some espionage and doesn't just wander into somewhere and start blowing things up. There is an actual Cold War spy story in there. And there is, I mean, this isn't a spy thing, but there is a fairly good plot here, I thought. Because with stories like this, and this is something I always run up against, I should say, in the sort of superhero comics world, which listeners will probably know, you know, is my sort of, or comics anyway, is my world, as it were. And one of the problems I have in that world is the ridiculousness of the sort of world-dominating plots of many supervillains.
Yes.
And that is an issue in Bond as well, obviously. But this one actually isn't that bad. I mean, the whole thing with subliminal hypnosis, you know, hypnotic suggestions and triggers and all that, that's all very Ipcress file, that's all very 60s. But if you accept that, the actual plot itself, you know, it's a bit like Goldfinger. It actually kind of makes sense. It's not as ridiculous as many Bond villain plots.
Well, and it's funny you should say the Ipcress file, because that's exactly what I thought this time through, when they start into the hallucinatory lighting and the hypnosis and everything.
It's a very 60s thing, wasn't it? This idea that you just sort of shine colored lights at people and play a recording and suddenly they're hypnotized and will do whatever you like.
Do you remember when you first came here? How you hated chickens? How you were sick when you even saw one? But all that is over now, for I have shown you how foolish it was, and your cure is nearly done. I have taught you to love chickens, to love their flesh, their voice. Yes, your cure is nearly done, and soon you will go home to look after the chickens, which you love so much.
You do love me, but just a little, teach you, don't you?
One more thing before you
go. Ruby.
I must teach you how to give them special care. I will tell you what to do.
Ruby.
I will tell you when. I will tell you how. And after you've done what I teach you, you will forget it forever. Forever.
Well, it's funny because, you know, watching Doctor Who this weekend as well, the Heaven Sent episode, it really reminded me of the kind of episodes you would get in something like The Prisoner or you know, a lot of the 60s spy things would always have one or two episodes where it would just be this freakish trap with one or two people trying to break one another. And or hypnotize one another.
The Avengers famously did one like that, didn't they? Where it was pretty much the whole episode was just Steed and Mrs. Peel trying to escape a. It was like a maze, and there was mirrors and with
rooms shifting and
that's it,
doors
yeah.
and everything. It's called The House That Jack Built.
Oh, of course you it's called.
I might have a thing for Emma Peel. I'm just saying.
Who doesn't?
You know, I, yeah. Anyway, and so, yeah, it really was this sort of very 60s spy trope, I guess, of let's do this, let's trap them in the room, and let's flash the lights, and now they're brainwashed.
Yeah, it's really weird. But one of the other things that, I mean, again, you know, getting back specifically to this movie and the sort of criticisms of it, obviously... Lazenby was a criticism. Some people did criticize the plot, which I thought was as being like overly complicated. And I'm like, this really isn't, you know, it really isn't at all. But one of the things that even at the time that people praised it for was the big action sequences.
Yes.
And they are great. Like even looking at them now, okay, you've got to make allowances for, you know, the special effects capabilities of the time and stuff. But in terms of pacing and camera angles and the lighting and stuff, they were pretty great.
Oh gosh, yes. Some of the car sequences, especially when they wind up in the car chase that winds up in the stock car race on the ice.
Mm.
That is some nice work. And that's, you know, that's coming on the heels of films like Grand Prix and John Frankenheimer doing these insane car sequences. And this stands up to any of those.
Absolutely. And most of the driving there was actually done by Diana Rigg, apparently, because there were so many close-ups.
You know,
a lot of the driving was actually done by the actors.
And you can really tell, because there are scenes where, you know, like they're skiing or Bond is in the bobsleigh at the end, and you can tell when it's rear projection, and you can tell when they have the close-up of Diana Rigg in the car, that's not rear projection. That's they're sliding around on the ice, and that is something.
Well, and in that sequence specifically, you can also see the fear on George Lazenby's face. and he apparently was. This is one of the things that he mentioned after the movie, was that he was terrified during that sequence because he didn't regard Diana Rigg as basically being a safe driver, a safe stunt driver, you know.
It's the best acting in the movie.
Yeah.
No, exactly. No.
But yeah, those action sequences are just beautifully shot. And that's something that, again, in recent years, as people have sort of reassessed their reaction to the movie, you know, that has become a sort of consensus opinion that even if you don't like the rest of the movie, in terms of just the action, it has some of the best sequences in any of those early era Bond movies. And I think I'd agree with that.
Oh, yeah. What's really interesting to me, too, is that the director of the film had been the editor for the previous few films, and he got the job because of his fast cutting and his, you know, his skill at pacing the action and the stories.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. And apparently he took it really seriously, and, you know, he came to the set every day with an annotated copy of the novel, and he was part of who determined that he wanted it to be much more like the books, and much more like From Russia with Love, which, I mean, it's kind of interesting that You Only Live Twice, which is the prior film, is the first one to pretty much throw out the book.
Oh, is that nothing like the book at all?
It is almost nothing like the book. The basis of the plot is totally different. In the novel, it is basically Bond going, he finds out that Blofeld has been living undercover in Japan as Dr. Guntram Shatterhand. And he and Irma Bunt have been living in this island fortress in Japan. And it, so it's basically just a revenge thing. It's him going after Blofeld for killing Tracy at the end of this. Spoiler!
Which is kind of funny, because in this, certainly in the movie at any rate, of this, that is pretty much his entire motivation here. Not for the death of Tracy, obviously, but just revenge.
Right, right. And they don't really lay that out very well. And that might be part of the problem with the movie, and part of the problem with the chronology of the movie, is that there's no real explanation for that. I mean, they sort of set Spectre up in previous movies, and you had the faceless arm stroking the white cat and all that. But, you know, what is there for him to be so vengeful about? I don't know.
Right, having defeated Spectre in, you know, a couple of his previous movies. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's a bit... But that is a big motivation throughout the whole thing. I mean, effectively, you know, is why he sort of tries to resign, you know, the fake resignation, because it is all revenge. So, yeah, that's really weird that that's actually the plot of the previous book that takes place after this story. Very confusing.
And so, yeah, there's no rocket ship thing. There's no volcano lair. There's no faked Bond death. At the beginning, I mean, it's You Only Live Twice is a really weird film.
And presumably he doesn't try and pass as a Japanese person.
No, he does do that.
Oh, God.
It's like, of all the things you could keep from the book, that's what you kept? Oh, my God. But it's kind of fun because the script is by Roald Dahl. So it's fun to watch that and see if you can pick out things that are very Dahl-like.
Mm.
But yeah, it's a really strange thing. So having gone so far away from the novel in the last one, this is the first one that, I mean, the others had followed the novels, but they trimmed and they cut and they rearranged details and stuff. This one, except for the opening sequence, they rearrange where Tracy tries to drown herself and they get attacked on the beach. That's a little bit later into the book. But aside from that, it pretty much follows every incident in the book. And I can see how, without any knowledge, I might have criticized it just for being too long.
It is a long movie, yeah, yeah.
It was the longest one up until Casino Royale, I think.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. And it is just excruciating at points. It's like, okay, we get it. Keep going. And so I it's funny that someone who was known for pacing and has really good pacing within sequences also turned out this really long film that could have been a little bit shorter.
Mm. Although, again, yeah, the actual pacing within the individual scenes, I mean, obviously within the action sequences, it's fantastic.
Yes.
But within even things like, say, the casino scene at the beginning, which is, you know, one of those... It's a slow scene in the sense that there's no action until he goes up to the room and gets attacked by the bodyguard. But, you know, it's all character and dialogue and what have you, and drama rather than action. But it's still a really well-done, well-paced scene. And actually, I think is one of the best scenes for Lazenby. I think he looks, I mean, obviously he looks good in the action sequences because he's a, he was a big, strong, physical, handsome guy. But I thought he looked really good in the casino scene as well. He had a sort of a languid ease, you know, almost like he played the role for years, which is apparently the complete opposite of what critics said at the time. So I don't know whether that's just me or whether that's, you know, sort of looking back. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder if they filmed that later in the shooting schedule because he's definitely more comfortable there.
He seems, he's you know, taking his time. He's a bit smoother. He's much more, just seems much more at ease with himself and with the character.
And I do appreciate the one or two little meta in-jokes, like at the very beginning when, just before the credits begin, where he's been beaten up on the beach and she runs off and all that, and he just stands there and he says,
"This never happened to the other fella."
And the music starts. It's like, okay, that's a nice touch. That's
and he says it direct to camera as well.
Yes.
No messing. See, I like that. That gets knocked by a lot of people. But yeah, I like it because Bond's always been a little self-aware.
And I think it works. I love it in Doctor Who when they make reference to the fact that, oh, it's another guy. It's right. Okay, you know?
We're all participating in this shared fiction. It's fine, you know. I also like that because it supports one of my favorite silly fan theories, which is, and I'm sure you've heard this one before, it's the idea that James Bond is actually just a code name given to whoever the current 007 is at this moment. So, you know, he dies and then a new guy comes in, becomes 007, adopts the James Bond persona, and that's why he looks completely different.
Which solves a multitude of sins in the series.
It does, but this movie itself screws that up because when he gets married, he's Mr. and Mrs. James Bond.
Yeah.
And then you get a movie like Skyfall, which completely blows that out of the water. So, you know, but I have always liked that as a concept.
Oh, yeah. I've also heard the theory that James Bond is a Time Lord. So
I haven't heard that one.
why you would regenerate into Roger Moore, I'm not sure, but okay.
Well, especially old Roger Moore as
well. Yeah. It's like, go young.
Yeah. Roger Moore was not a young man, even when he first became Bond, let alone by the time of, things like View to a Kill.
Oh, yeah. It's fun to watch early stuff with him. And again, to think, I think he was on their radar as early as Dr. No. Because he had already done a season of Maverick over here. He had done a series called The Alaskans, and he'd already started The Saint at that point.
Wait, Roger Moore was in Maverick?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
In the last year and a half of Maverick, when James Garner walked away from it, they kept bringing in more and more Maverick cousins to it's like, oh, well, here's Brent Maverick, who's kind of just generic American, and here's their cousin from across the ocean, Bo Maverick. And
what?
he was charming, and it is kind of like The Saint in the Old West for like five or six episodes.
See, if they were going to do that, they could have at least picked something that sounds like a vaguely British name. Bo? Bo? Never met any British person called Bo.
Well, it was B-E-A-U.
I don't know any French people called Bo either.
Yeah. It's weird. So yeah, you had Brett and Bart and Brent and Bo, and I think they had another.
The only English Bo I can think of is Bo Brummel, who like was alive in the 1800s, as far as I recall. Yeah.
So yeah, it's
Barry
it's
a, or you know.
It's a very odd bunch of episodes. Pretty much as soon as James Garner leaves, don't watch Maverick. It's
wow.
Just not right. But yeah, I mean, he was charming. He would have been adorable at that point as Bond.
Well, and he was adorable in, you know, as Bond when he took on the role.
Yeah.
It's just that he was way too old. He was, if I recall correctly, he was already older than Sean Connery was when Sean Connery made his final Bond movie.
I believe so. I think they're about, they were roughly the same age.
Right, yeah. Which is just
such an odd. Yeah. I mean, the producers of the Bond films, I have a love-hate relationship with them because, I mean, obviously the films have given me a lot of joy over the years, and at the same time, they frustrate me so often.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, like, Dalton. Dalton is fantastic.
So good, so good.
And the scripts are awful.
Terrible, yeah. Oh. What's your opinion of the kilt?
I'm okay with the kilt.
Okay, okay.
It's in the book.
Oh, is it? You know?
Yeah. Well, this and You Only Live Twice were the first ones he had written after Dr. No, the film. And that's where he started building up Bond's backstory that he had Scottish in his
family tree. Oh, I didn't know that.
And it was partly to excuse the fact that he's being played by a Scottish actor. That's literally the only reason.
Except then, of course, he gets portrayed by an Australian doing a bad British accent, pretending to have Scottish heritage.
That's right.
Oh, dear. But I like the kilt. Yeah. I ask because, again, I know that that's something that a lot of people don't like and a lot of people think makes him look ridiculous. But I can only assume that those people are American because to a Brit, you know, a man wearing a kilt is not... I mean, it's not like it's a common sight. Of yes, it's unusual, but yeah. It's not ridiculous. You know, it's just kind of he must be Scottish. He's wearing a kilt,
and it takes a certain security in your masculinity to wear a kilt, I would imagine.
And he looks good. You have to look good in it as well. That's the other thing.
Yes,
there's nothing worse than putting on a kilt and knowing that you look terrible. But he looks really good again because he's tall, fit, you know, handsome man. Quite muscular. Yeah, you know, he looks good in it.
Now, his tuxedo shirts are a little too ruffly for my taste, and I wonder if that's part of, you know, it's like, that looks too silly.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I know that he, apparently, the tuxedo that he wears was actually made for Sean Connery.
Oh,
and okay. Uncollected by Connery. So clearly they must have been about the same height and build. I don't know whether that's the case for the shirts. Don't know who made the shirts. And that actually reminds me of in the opening sequence. Like, I love that opening sequence in some ways. Well, much like the movie in some ways. And then there are, like, they try and hide his face.
Yeah.
Obviously, first movie with a different actor. So, you know, you get these close-ups of him putting a cigarette in his mouth and lighting it, close-ups of his hand. You never sort of see his face. And so you think, oh, this is going to be a big reveal. But then he just steps out the car and starts stripping off to jump into the water. And it's just an average medium length shot. There's no dramatic music. There's no close up. It's just, I don't know, it just feels kind of wasted.
Yeah. Yeah. When the thing that struck me too with that is that by rearranging that scene, he has to be psychic, right? In the book, he understands what Tracy is doing. And so, of course, he's going to stop and rip off his shirt and try and pull her out of the ocean. Whereas in this version, maybe she's just going swimming. He doesn't know who she is.
Right, you know, right.
It's very odd. And then people try to beat him up. That just happens.
To be fair, she's not really wearing gear for swimming.
That's
she's
true.
Not really dressed That's for true. Swimming, is she?
But, you know, it's like pretty much all it is that he's passed by this woman driving fast, and then she stops and goes and walks into the ocean.
Yeah,
and the only reason he goes after her is because she's driving fast. And, well, if you see Diana Rigg driving fast past you, okay, yes, I would give chase too.
Well, I was going to say, and she is very pretty as well. So, yes. You know, being Bond, obviously, we know that that helps. But the reason I mentioned that, the reason it came to mind was because you mentioned the wet shirts, and, you know, that's famously the fight sequence with the guys trying to attack him on the beach, in the water. He's all, you know, sort of Mr. Darcy style, wet and, you know, his pecs showing through the shirt and whatever. But what got me, what really made me laugh about the sequence is that, of course, he's wearing a tuxedo. Like, we haven't even seen where he's come from. He's just apparently AWOL and MI6 don't know where he is. And what's he doing? He's driving around the Italian mountain roads wearing a tuxedo.
As you do,
because that's what James Bond does.
Yeah, there were, I mean, yeah, there are just so many things in this that work, and then so many things that are
Telly Savalas. We haven't mentioned him yet at all.
That's true.
I think he's great.
He is great. I prefer Donald Pleasance as Blofeld, but without that, again, looking at the abstract, he does a great job with it. He's delightfully menacing. He's just that knife edge of sane and insane, which you need for a good Bond villain. And at the time, having grown up with him as Kojak, it was like, oh my God, Telly Savalas is a bad guy.
Right, yeah. Yeah, which before Kojak was not unusual at all.
Right.
Because he was just a character actor on loads of serials, wasn't he? But yes, post-Kojak, seeing him as a villain is shocking. But I thought he played it really well, yeah. I mean, yes, it is very different to Donald Pleasance, but as you say, he's menacing. He, you know, appears smart. He plays it sort of with an edge of, you know, ego that somebody like Blofeld will have. And let's be honest, can you imagine Donald Pleasance skiing?
Not really. which is apparently part of why they recast that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They said, we don't think Donald Pleasance can do the action things we need him to do.
Right.
So we'll get this guy.
Was this the first Bond ski chase, actually, in a movie?
I think it might have been.
It's been a long time since I saw any of the Connery movies, except From Russia with Love. And that doesn't, you know, there are definitely no ski chase sequences in that.
I mean, Goldfinger takes place almost entirely in Kentucky, which is really odd to me.
Of course, that's local to you, isn't it?
That's right. It's like, Bond doesn't happen here. No.
Is there any skiing in Japan?
I do not think so.
Huh.
I am pretty sure this is the first skiing sequences. And I think they were the same guy who wound up directing them for Spy Who Loved Me and View to a Kill and all the other classics and for Your Eyes Only too.
Well, and that's the thing. It's now, you know, a Bond ski chase is, I wouldn't say de rigueur, but it's a common part of the cinematic Bond franchise.
Yeah. There's what, the whole snow sequence in The Living Daylights.
Yep.
Which obviously is not from a direct novel, so they intentionally did that.
Well, and there's one inspector in the new movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that reminds me, I apparently, Chris Nolan has gone on record saying that Honor Majesty's Secret Service was an influence on Inception. Because of the whole assault on the, you know, on the snow base, on the fortress in the snow scene in Inception. Apparently that was, you know, this was an inspiration for that. And I can see that actually, knowing that and looking at the sort of the final assault on the fortress here with the helicopters and things blowing up and what have you, I can see how that, yeah, you know, because Chris Nolan, again, is about our age, about my age, about your age.
Yeah.
So he also would have probably grown up watching Bond and then sort of gone back and seen this in retrospect. So yeah, maybe it just stuck with him.
Yeah, when I was little, I used to play Bond out in the backyard where I would imagine these massive, you know, armies of mercenaries coming to save the day and mounting the assault on the villain's lair. And it was always either the volcano from You Only Live Twice, or it was Peace Gloria from Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Those were what I played in my head.
Yeah, high up in the Alps, which is apparently still there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a restaurant.
I was going to say, is it still a restaurant or?
I don't know.
Not sure. It certainly was at the time, yeah.
But it's a beautiful location, and it just looks like a villain's lair.
Right, yeah, which is ironic given that it's just a restaurant. But then that's the Alps for you. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you've ever been to the Alps, but they are enormous. It's kind of, and I don't just mean that in terms of, you know, sort of being tall mountains, which they are, you know, obviously, but they cover an enormous area. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like, I remember the first time I flew home from Seattle and realized the extent of the Cascades in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah. You know,
just, oh my goodness, this covers such an enormous area of ground. I mean, obviously the Rockies, you know that, but then you see the Cascades and you're like, my God, this covers a huge area of ground. And the Alps is like that until you see them. And I've flown over them several times as well, to and from work in Eastern Europe. And you don't realize how enormous the expanse of the Alps is until you fly over them. and you just look down and you're like, we've been flying over these mountains for a long time now, and they're still there. But yeah, I associate, you know, sort of the Alps and ski chases and mountain retreats and all that. You know, when I think of Bond, that is one of the things that comes to mind. And yeah, it's, you know, sort of crazy to think that this actually, this maligned movie is where that template was set.
Yeah. And, you know, it does follow enough of what we know of a Bond film, which, again, you know, it's built into the book. It's there. Where it has, you know, he sort of stumbles into each next step of the story. Yeah. But then there are those moments where you have the ski chase and the ice car chase and the bobsleighs. You know, it's kind of interesting. And then to see things where, like, the bobsled chase goes on a little bit long. Mm. It could be a little trimmer, because there's nothing else going on at the same time. It is just that chase.
Right, and it's literally on rails. So, yeah. Well, not literally on rails, but certainly.
But close enough.
Close.
It's on a track.
Close to literally.
Now, when I was young, we had a wonderful toy and hobby shop near where I lived, and my father was a model railroader, so we would go there all the time. And they had this bin up in the front of the store. It wasn't even organized, but they just had all of the Corgi die-cast cars. And it's, you know, some of them would just be random cars, but I managed to get, like, all of the James Bond cars. I had the Aston Martin from Goldfinger with a little button that you could push, and it had an ejector seat. And I had the bobsled with a little tiny Blofeld.
And, oh, wow.
And I had the Lotus from Spy Who Loved Me and the Citroen from For Your Eyes Only. Oh, I wish I still had those somewhere. I might. I don't know that I do. I think I might have gotten rid of them.
Which one was the one that turned into a sob? Was that the Lotus?
That was the Lotus, yeah.
Right, I had that one, yeah.
Oh, I love that car.
Complete with, and it was a double regular size toy. You know, you had the little matchbox scale. This was double size, I presume, for the mechanics to fit in, because you could pop the wheels under and press a button and the fins would pop out of the sides instead.
Yeah, I loved that car.
And speaking of gadgets and stuff, that's one thing that's kind of is missing from this movie. And I know that was a criticism leveled at it at the time.
Yeah. And that was a choice. That was intentionally, they said, we want to get away from that.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of ironic given that with many other Bond movies, one of the criticisms is the over-reliance on what are perceived to be silly gadgets.
Right.
And you know, you can't win for choosing, can you? It's, you know, so now they decide to do away with the gadgets and they get called boring because there's no highfalutin, you know, deadly gadgets at play.
And it's always the thing of where they feel like they have to top the last one. And they did kind of get that way by You Only Live Twice, where you have the little tiny helicopter thing that he flies around and all the other fun gadgets. Yeah. And so this one it's sort of like a hard restart. It's like, let's just go back to basics. We'll do a good spy film. And then Diamonds Are Forever brings it back up. And then each one after that has a little bit bigger. And like the one that killed me, because I did enjoy the Brosnan films for the most part. I thought he was a very good Bond. My mother and I both agreed that he was a little too pretty. He would have been he would have been way too pretty when they originally wanted him.
He was making Remington Steele,
He needed a little weathering and a little aging. But you know, by the time of GoldenEye, he's great. And each of those amps up the silly gadgets until you have the invisible car in Die Another Day. Yes. And I just, you know, again, there were a lot of things I enjoyed in that. That was not one of them.
Yeah, Brosnan is one where I thought he was a great Bond, but pretty much GoldenEye is the only one of those movies that I actually genuinely enjoy and would happily watch again. All of the others, not so much, which is a shame because, yeah, he was great as Bond. I mean, he looked so good, as did Lazenby in this. You know, being an ex-model helped. Although there again, apparently that was a criticism at the time, was that he...
He's too big.
No, he was too pretty.
Oh.
Was that he was too pretty and he didn't have the kind of, you know, rough suave, if that's not a contradiction in terms of that Connery had developed over, you know, the course of several movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily call Connery pretty.
No.
Handsome. Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, and I think that's the difference, isn't it? Yeah. Connery, you could say he's handsome, whereas Lazenby, yes, he was handsome, but he was handsome in a pretty way. He was a very smooth, long-lashed, you know, tall, dark, handsome man.
One thing that's kind of fun is the how music sets the tone, too. For instance, with Tomorrow Never Dies, which is a flawed film, they had a terrific theme song with K.D. Lang as the singer, and it sounds like it should be a Shirley Bassey song. I mean, it sounds like a Bond theme.
Right.
And they decided that they wanted to go with a more popular singer, so they had Sheryl Crow write a song, which is a fine song. And they included the K.D. Lang song over the end credits. And I maintain if we had seen the film starting with that, it would have colored, it would have gotten us past some of the things that were not as effective in the movie. And I think that might be something working here. This is the first Bond film that didn't have a title theme, that was just an instrumental. And it's a good instrumental. I like it, but it's different. And you know, maybe that's sort of a general thing, is that there's so many little things in this that were different that it might have been too much to throw at the audience all at once with a brand new actor.
Right.
Right? It has a different setup. It has a different way into the plot. He doesn't meet up with M until half an hour into the movie to get his mission. You know, it's everything about it is a little off compared to what we as the audience are used to in a Bond film at that point.
Does he even meet with Q at all?
I do not think he does.
I mean, Q's in the movie, but I think it might just be Q and M talking. I don't think Bond actually meets Q at any point. Yeah, which is when you think of, again, the tropes of what a Bond movie brings to mind, you expect him to get his gadgets from Q.
Yeah.
But we know that getting a Bond theme right is difficult as well. That's the thing. You're right that it was a really odd choice to do an instrumental for this one. But even when they're not instrumental, getting a Bond theme right is clearly a lot trickier than people think, because, you know, you can look back and point to classic Bond themes. You say, well, there are loads of them. Well, yes, but there are also loads of movies. And I'd say it's probably less than 50% of all the Bond movies have actually had great theme songs.
Oh, absolutely.
And we saw that just this year with the Spectre theme song, which was, you know, not a bad song, but just kind of underwhelming.
Eh, I'd go with bad.
I think it was better in the...
In context?
Right. And and in the cinema as well. You know, when you're seeing it on a big screen with the big sound system, it has more impact there, sure.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't have enough impact. And, you know, you look back at, well, as you said, the Sheryl Crow one, perfectly good song, not really a great Bond theme. Yeah. The Chris Cornell, again, you know, great song, sort of over the end credits, great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But opening titles, not so much.
Yeah, I loved that when they released it. And then when I saw it in context, I went, that's not quite right.
Right, exactly. That's what I say. There's clearly something ineffable about and hard to define about a Bond theme that, yeah, people struggle to get right. I think it's notable that the first one for years that pretty much everybody agreed was a great theme was Skyfall, which, of course, you know, weighs another British diva singing, you know, over swelling strings and stuff. You're like, oh, okay. So maybe there is something to this.
And you know, one of the things that watching Skyfall this weekend reinforced is I paid attention to the music more, and that theme and elements of that theme are worked into the score much more organically than in a lot of films where they just go, oh, let's get Sheryl Crow. And and that song, again, you know, fine song, it's not really integrated into the score very well. Whereas in Skyfall, you're watching a pretty good movie. I mean, yeah, it falls apart when you sit and analyze it.
Right. It doesn't. Yeah.
You know, but I really enjoy it. It's one of the ones I can watch over and over again. And actually, my son was sort of stunned. He made the connection by himself that not only was it an inversion of the Bond trope, where instead of Bond and an army going to the villain's lair, it was the villain and an army going to Bond's lair. And then it turned into Home Alone, just a lot more brutal than Home Alone. And so I was like, oh, that's my boy. But, you know, you have that. You're watching this really good film and having those themes over and over again, reinforcing everything. And you go, that is a great Bond theme.
Mm.
And it does fit in beautifully against the traditional James Bond theme. That is a spectacular song. I love Tom Jones' Thunderball, partly because I just like Tom Jones wailing, but it's kind of interesting. There are a lot of rejected Bond themes out online now, and that one was apparently really hard to get a song for. Johnny Cash apparently, of his own volition, sent in a song for Thunderball.
Yeah, I heard about this.
It's very good as a Johnny Cash Western song. It is awful as a Bond film, a Bond theme.
Right.
And I will warn you, I'll send you a link to it because it's worth putting in the show notes. It is an earworm. It will get stuck in your head.
Oh no.
But you know, if you're okay with that, listen to it. But yeah, it is everything that could go wrong in a Bond theme. So you can see why they didn't use that.
And, you know, you're right about using motifs and sort of calling back to the theme during the movie helping. But again, that's notably something they didn't do in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, because what they did do, much like you were saying with the 50th anniversary, what they did do was keep calling back to previous Bond movies. Like the opening titles, you have shots from previous movies.
Right, it's all the Bond girls from all the Connery films.
Right. It's almost like you're sort of like they're trying to reassure you. Don't worry, it's still a Bond movie.
Look, it's Ursula Andress. You liked Ursula Andress.
Yeah, it's very odd, very odd.
And the music that they do call back to doesn't actually show up until the end of the movie.
Right. The famous Bond movie. Yeah, Bond theme. See, yeah. Me, you got me doing it. I think that's a signal that it's probably time for us to bring this to a close. But yeah, I mean, I think this is a good movie. No, it's not the best Bond movie, but it is, although apparently there are some fan polls where people do rate this as the best Bond movie, which I think is bizarre.
I would put it in my top five.
Right, exactly. Yeah, same here. But I would urge listeners, if you haven't watched On Her Majesty's Secret Service for a while, or even before, don't be put off by people saying, oh, it's terrible because it's the one with Lazenby. Like, yes, Lazenby, like I said, he's not the greatest actor in the world, but I think he occupies the role pretty well. And I think it's a shame that he decided not to do any more, because I think if he had persisted, he could have actually been a great Bond. I think we could have had some great, great Bond movies with him in the role.
I agree. And considering the books they had left to work with at that point, it would have been interesting to see those develop from this kind of a Bond and a serious Bond.
Right. More like Dalton. Again, I wish Dalton had stuck around for longer, or that they had kept Dalton around for
longer. I think it was more like keeping him.
Yeah. Did he jump or was he pushed? Oh, he was pushed.
Yeah. Oh, my heart aches for Dalton. I love Dalton.
Ah, me too. Anyway, but yes, you should watch it if you haven't before. And if you haven't for a long time, go back and reassess it, definitely.
Yeah, go watch it with an open mind. And you know, and if nothing else, there's Diana Rigg. No, she's not Emma Peel, but she is a Bond heroine who is a little more in control of her life. She's more of an equal to him than most.
And she does have at least one fight scene where she kicks ass.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the very end, she gets punched out to be rescued and they let the men do all the rescuing.
Right. Yeah.
But she's trying to, you know, she's like, no, I'm going to do this too. And her father just goes, boom, come on.
The fact that it's a father who punches her unconscious. Man, gender politics of the 60s.
Now, and my son, having watched a bunch of Avengers, is like, man, she could kick ass better than any of those guys. Let her fight. Come on.
Absolutely true. All right, David, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
They can find me at DLOEHR on Twitter. They can find me at the Incomparable Radio Theater, which is theincomparable.com/radio. We've got another bunch of episodes coming up in January. We've got a big Christmas special, which is a supersized episode. It's kind of crazy. And those would probably be the easiest places to find me and find what I'm doing.
Excellent. And I know I joked about it at the start, but I really would urge listeners to go and check out the Radio Theatre because it is it's a great show. And
thank
yes,
you.
The Christmas special will be, is that actually coming out on Christmas Day?
I'm not sure, but it'll be right around Christmas Day.
Right. It's probably not out by the time this episode goes live, but very, very shortly after. So keep an eye out for that as well. And once again, David, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I will gladly come and talk anything. we will find more things that are maligned.
Oh, I'm sure. There are many of them out there. All right. Merry Christmas, everyone. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned, and please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Quite a few of them are spy stories, so if you like a bit of Bond, I've probably written something you'd enjoy. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes, and if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening. Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season to all, and we will see you in the new year. I'd actually completely forgotten about this until I watched it again. I love how a huge part of Blofeld's motivation is him wanting to be acknowledged as nobility.
Oh, yes.
Wanting to be the Comte de Bluchamp, which is like, if his plan in this movie works, he will literally be the most powerful man in the world. And yet, his vanity is so great that he still insists that he be recognized as a titled noble man. And that's, I mean, I think M sums it up in a beautiful throwaway line when they're talking about that with Bond towards the end. And he just says, you know, snobbery is an awful thing.
Well, and it's not even that it's a legitimate thing. I mean, he's bobbed his earlobes to fit into the genetics of this.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, yeah. They don't have earlobes in that family. Well, okay, he's cut them off.
I'll cut mine off, yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's this strange misplaced vanity. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that in the book? The whole,
it is.
The earlobes thing,
yeah.
I mean, specifically.
It is. I mean, that's all there.
Well, I'm just wondering, because this is long before they would have had the ability, obviously, to like sort of remove his earlobes in post-process, you know what I mean, in post-production with special effects. So did they cast Telly Savalas because he doesn't have earlobes?
I think I read somewhere that they pinned them back somehow.
Oh,
but I'm not
okay.
Sure. And I haven't really looked carefully at photos of him afterwards. I suppose I could do that right now.
Oh, wow. That must have been painful.
I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's definitely got earlobes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's got big earlobes.
And yeah, I always forget how backloaded, is that a word, that this movie is in terms of like the setup takes forever.
Yes.
But then when it kicks off, it's like, boom, 45 minutes of action, nonstop.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much once he gets to the hallucinogenic part of the plan, it doesn't stop.
Mm.
But yeah, you have to get all the way through everything about Tracy, and then you have to get all the way up to Piz Gloria, and you have to get all the way through the dinner with that really odd sequence of continually cutting to what the women are eating.
Oh, yeah.
That's a really odd sequence.
Well, I assume that's to emphasize that they've gotten over their allergies.
Oh, yeah.
But up until that point, you have no idea what their allergies are. So it's, you know, I mean, and they mention it because I think Ruby, the main girl, says like, oh, I couldn't eat potatoes or, oh no, it's chickens. Sorry, wasn't it? Yeah. But there's another girl who couldn't eat potatoes and she's tucking into a plate of potatoes. But she has to explicitly say that for you to understand why this has any meaning. It's so bizarre.
And they keep cutting to shots of the plates getting emptier and emptier and dirtier and dirtier. And I'm thinking, these are possibly the strangest shots in any Bond film. And that says something, because there's some weird stuff in Bond films.
I think Skyfall's a wonderful movie and a great spectacle, but it doesn't stand up to a moment's analysis. Yeah. You know, it doesn't pass the fridge test.
Yeah. And I love it.
Yeah. No, it's the same here. But yeah, it's for anybody who doesn't know, the fridge test is where you finish watching the movie and then 5 minutes later you're in the fridge getting yourself a beverage and you suddenly stop and go, wait a second.
Yep.
And you realize that what you've just been watching makes no sense at all.
We watched to the beginning of For Your Eyes Only, and that's the one where they have the unnamed but obviously Blofeld, because they were sort of sending a middle finger to Kevin McClory. And so it's the remote control helicopter where Blofeld is going to kill Bond, and Bond takes control of the helicopter and scoops Blofeld up on he's in his wheelchair. He scoops him up on the front of the helicopter and drops him down a steam pipe, a steam tower of some sort, or a smokestack, I guess. And, you know, I mean, it's weird, but it's okay for a Moore film. And then there's that point just at the end where not Blofeld is pleading for his life, and he goes, I'll buy you a delicatessen made of stainless steel. And then he drops him down the smokestack. And it's like, what does that mean?
What did I just watch?
That doesn't make any sense.
Oh, I'm sorry. My mind's gone completely blank.
That's all right. It's that time of year.
Oh, it really is. It really is.